This is Gaza Corner, featuring news and analysis from the Middle East and beyond that's often ignored by the mainstream media. The views and opinions expressed on Gaza Corner are those of me, Dori Stein, and the guests who appear, and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of KALW Public Media. Our guest on Gaza Corner is Rob Malley, co-author with Hussein Agha of the new book, Tomorrow is Yesterday, Life, Death, and the Pursuit of Peace in Israel-Palestine. Welcome to Gaza Corner.
Thanks so much for inviting me.
Rob co-authored the book with Hussein Agha, who for decades advised former PLO leader Yasser Arafat and Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas. Rob Malley worked under Presidents Clinton, Obama, and Biden as a senior Middle East official. He's also a veteran negotiator in U.S.-backed talks between Israeli and Palestinian leadership, most notably at Camp David in 2000, that brought together Yasser Arafat and Israeli Prime Minister at that time, Ehud Barak. Rob was the lead negotiator on the 2015 Iran nuclear deal and the former president of the International Crisis Group. Most everyone is familiar with the proverb, "The acorn doesn't fall far from the tree." Tell us about your mom and dad and how they shaped your frame of reference in regards to the Middle East.
So my father was an Egyptian Jew who was in many ways an outsider, first Jewish in a majority Muslim country, anti-Zionist among Jews, and very active militant Arab nationalist, who then moves to the States, where he is a consistent and ferocious critic of American policy, then moves to France, where he is a critic of French policy, so much so that he gets expelled from France. He was sort of the outsider outside of any world in which he never fit.
Mitterrand let him back in, though, right?
Mitterrand let him back in, yes, as soon as he was elected. So Giscard d'Estaing was president when he was expelled. Mitterrand gets elected, and one of the first things he does, not the first thing, but eight early things he did was to let my father back in. Which did not mean that my father didn't then proceed to criticize Mitterrand's African policies, but a critic one's a critic always. My mother also a Jew, but of Eastern European origin, and she was born and raised in the Bronx. And maybe in a way more surprising than my father's trajectory, I still haven't figured out why. My mother, single child from the Bronx, from parents who didn't have that much international experience, she decides that she's going to volunteer for the Algerian Liberation Front, the FLN, back in the 50s, when they were pushing and struggling for independence. She volunteered to be in their office at the UN. And through common friends, she met my father, and the rest is history. So when I look at my background compared to the background of other people who were part of the peace team, the so-called peace team under the Clinton administration and then the Obama administration, I'm not a carbon copy of my father or mother by any means, and we had more arguments than I could count. But I came from a background that was very sympathetic to Palestinian cause. Most of my colleagues came from a background that's satisfied with the generous offers. It's another metaphor that comes up all the time, the generous offers that Israel made. Since you're the losing party, you know, the alternative to the offer that may not be ideal but is generous is a return to the horror that you're living now that you were living before. And that gets repeated over and over again, this assumption that because they are the weaker party, the party that has been vanquished, they have to accept it. And if they don't, there's something irrational about them. And so then you also have this quest for the reasonable, quote-unquote, Palestinians, those who understand that their objective should be to get a better life, even if it means giving up, relinquishing some of their aspirations, some of the dignity, some of the moral issues that to which they cling. Another illusion, because those moderate Palestinians may be exactly the Palestinians the Americans want. They're not the Palestinians the Palestinians want. And so they end up not having particular relevance or particular legitimacy in the eyes of their constituents. And then, of course, I think the ultimate reason why the U.S. did so little, even though it had so much, is that it didn't really care. And by that, I don't mean that, you know, I think President Clinton, I think President Obama genuinely cared and wanted to get a peace deal. But in the pecking order of strategic priorities between, you know, dealing with China, Russia, whatever, getting peace between Israelis and Palestinians, that was not exactly something for which presidents were prepared to sacrifice political capital, regional alliances with Israel, whatever else it may be. And so what ends up is that the pursuit of peace itself, just the pursuit, is what substitutes for the attainment of the goal. And it's good enough because by pursuing peace, you can satisfy local critics by saying, look, we're trying. You satisfy Arab governments who themselves don't care that much about the Palestinians, but you say, at least, look, we're making an effort, so don't interfere too much because we're trying. So you kind of satisfy various constituencies, various strategic objectives. You don't really need to take that final step of putting all the pressure that it would take, particularly on Israel, to get a solution that would be satisfactory to both sides. So you compare that, I had that experience of working for presidents on Israel-Palestine and then working for President Obama on Iran. And it was night and day. President wanted to deal with Iran, but he also considered it a strategic objective. So he was prepared to overcome domestic opposition from Republicans and a majority of the Democratic caucus in the Senate and the House. He was prepared to overcome Israeli objection, Arab Gulf objection. He was prepared to do it because he felt it was critical for the U.S. national security interests. He and others simply couldn't view the Israel or didn't view the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in the same light. And so, yeah, they would try, and sometimes some of the efforts were in good faith, some less so, but never with the kind of muscle, the kind of leverage, kind of willingness to invest political capital that would have been required to get somewhere. Instead of getting somewhere, the U.S. was a handmaiden to the perpetuation of the status quo.
And your point about Obama, the prioritization of foreign policy goals, there's a quote by Obama. He says, "It's hard to see why Israel would change course if it doesn't incur the price of the policies it's pursuing." And yet, in 2016, here's Obama and VP Biden giving Israel a 10-year, $38 billion military package. How does that jive?
So this is something he said to some of us at the end of his presidency. I mean, what he also said was, it's not irrational for Prime Minister Netanyahu to pursue the policies that he's pursuing. What's irrational is for people to assume and to think that he'll change those policies simply because we ask him to. Again, I have a lot of affection and admiration for President Obama. I do think in some ways he was a president who was cut off in mid-sentence. He didn't complete his own sentence. This sentence, which is recognizing that Israel would only move if you put pressure on it, but second half of the sentence should be, and therefore we're going to put pressure, but he didn't. In some ways, and I hate psychoanalyzing or doing too much analysis of people who, other than myself, but I think President Obama kind of had some out-of-body experience sometimes. Like he was a fantastic analyst, including of himself. And so he could sit back and say, this is what I'm doing. What I'm doing now, I know why I'm doing it. I'm under political constraints. It would be too costly for me to take the actions vis-a-vis Israel that I should take if I really wanted to achieve what I said I want to achieve. And so all of this is going to be, it's going to cost too much. So I could see myself doing what's going to fail, but I know why I'm doing it. I'm smart enough, and which he was, to be able to diagnose the reasons why the policies he was pursuing were not going to achieve the goal that he had set out. And on this one, I think Ben Rhodes, who was his deputy national security advisor, once said, I believe he mentions it in his book, here's a president, the first black president of the United States. And as you know, there's this suspicion that black Americans are too pro-Palestinian, the militant terrorists. There was somewhere lurking in the back of his mind this notion that if he went too far, he immediately would be tarred with that brush, which he was by many Israelis, of being Islamist close to the Palestinians. So he always had to be a bit careful because he was on thin ice. And his whole presidency, people were trying to discredit and delegitimize him.
You were part of the Clinton, the Obama, and the Biden administrations, and during all those administrations, Israel was able to entrench its occupation. And at the same time, the kind of the mantra of the administrations was trying to search for a two-state solution. You call it, quote unquote, a gimmick. And there's a line, and I'll quote this. two-state solution evolved from abstract idea to colonial-inspired policy to seemingly viable diplomatic venture to ambivalent hope to joke and finally big expedient lie. That is from the book.
Yeah, as we know, the origins were not Palestinian or Zionist or Israeli. The idea originally comes from the Brits, and then it's the UN partition plan. The moment during which Israelis and Palestinians both, their leaderships agree on a two-state solution, matter of a couple, 3 years, and even then you could question how much the Israelis truly believed it. Palestinians, for most of their history before that, didn't, before Oslo, for the late 80s. So there's only a short period where both parties truly embrace or claim to embrace the notion of a two-state solution. What is particularly striking is how Americans, not just Americans, but Americans in particular, you know, they were very ambivalent. The first American president who formally endorses the idea of a Palestinian state is President Bush Jr. That's the first one who makes it American policy. But they continue to talk about a two-state solution, even when everything on the ground is moving in the opposite direction. In fact, sometimes the more they move in the opposite direction, the louder they are in speaking about it. And the height of the lie didn't start as a lie, as I said, evolved into a lie once you keep saying it, when you have nothing else to say, when it's your last refuge, because you need to show that you're trying to reach something, that you're not giving up. And the only familiar outcome or the one that people know about is a two-state solution. So you keep up that mantra, we're working for the two-state solution, even if that work is purely symbolic, purely rhetorical, and even if everything that matters is moving in the other direction. The height of that lie came under the Biden administration. You know, President Biden, maybe rightfully, didn't believe for when he was elected, and I would say even when he was vice president, that there would be a Palestinian state. I think I mentioned even when I served in the Obama administration, he was vice president, he felt Palestinian state was something that some activists in the U.S. and some activists in the Arab world believe in, but Arab governments didn't talk about it and nobody really believed in it anymore. And so it was just sort of, yeah, fine if you want to pursue it, but it's not going to happen. During his presidency, he didn't really fight for it. I think a year before October 7, 2023, he was with President Abbas and he said something like, you know, conditions aren't ripe now to move towards a two-state solution. That's what he said then.
And we should say President Abbas is the president of the Palestinian Authority.
Yes. Come October 7th, and months later, this feeling, both in the U.S., overseas as well, that the U.S. is complicit in a genocide, that the U.S. has been completely, not just unable to stop Israel, but complicit in feeding the war machine. And at that point is when the Biden administration suddenly rediscovers the two-state solution and says they're working on an irreversible pathway to two states, at a time when the conditions are as bad as they've ever been, when nobody in the region believed, nobody serious believed that the Biden administration was really get to a two-state solution. But that, for Hussein and I, really epitomized the gimmickry that the two-state solution had become, the phrase that people trot out when they need to say that they're doing something, when they're actually doing nothing, or worse than nothing.
That's Rob Molley, the co-author with Hussein Agha of the new book, Tomorrow is Yesterday, Life, Death, and the Pursuit of Peace in Israel-Palestine. Rob, is it fair to say that the seeds of this book go back to an essay that you co-wrote with Hussein in the New York Review of Books that was called Camp David, The Tragedy of Errors? Because we know that so many false narratives have been taken as truth that are clearly false, but these are narratives that the corporate mainstream media latch onto by Israel and it takes on a life of its own. And certainly blaming the Palestinians for the failure of Camp David is one of them.
I mean, so I think it is the first time that Hussein and I, we knew each other beforehand, but that was the first article we wrote together. And, you know, we debated, Hussein and myself, when we were writing the book, how much we want to go back to an event that occurred 25 years ago that seems irrelevant. I mean, what happened at Camp David, when today in the Israeli government, not a single cabinet member believes in a Palestinian state. And when 80% or more of the Israeli public is against the Palestinian state, when no party represented in the Israeli parliament, the Knesset, other than the Arab parties, is in favor of two states. So still today, people want to sort of unearth what happened at Camp David in order to blame the Palestinians. In the end, we did write about it and try to once again demystify so many of those myths, because it is being used. It's being invoked almost more than ever by not just the media, but by many officials who were senior officials at the time. And you can imagine who I'm talking about, who say, if only young Americans knew what President Clinton offered generously on a platter to Yasser Arafat in 2000, they would not be out there demonstrating against Israel. I mean, there's so much that is unpacking that statement, as if even if the Palestinians were responsible for the collapse of Camp David in 2000, somehow it would justify the massacres that have been perpetrated against Palestinians since October 7th. So number one. But number two, that myth that Camp David was the place where the Palestinians could have had a sovereign, meaningful state, it was all out there and they said no. It was an extraordinarily harmful myth then, because it discredited, well, it first of all demonized Arafat, it demonized his movement, and it discredited not just the Palestinian movement, but to the largest extent the Palestinian people. You have Ehud Barak, the Israeli prime minister at the time, who wrote in response to our article, you know, the Palestinians come from a culture where they don't make a distinction between truth and lies. Mm. So the whole Camp David becomes sort of a outgrowth of this culture. And by the way, it also killed the peace camp in Israel. So it has had this extraordinarily harmful impact to this day of people saying that that's sort of the original sin of the Palestinians. And as we try to show in the book, it's so oversimplistic. It's not like the Palestinians are blameless by any means, but the notion that they're the only ones to blame and Americans and the Israelis are not. Again, I hope people will listen to this interview and read the book, but it would take us too long to try to go through the list of reasons why that's a myth. But I'll just give one quick illustration. Shlomo Ben-Ami, who was the Israeli foreign minister at the time of Camp David, a member, senior member, maybe the second most senior member of Ehud Barak's team, he wrote soon thereafter Camp David that if he had been the Palestinian leader at the time, he would have rejected the ideas that were presented at Camp David because they were unbalanced and they were not respectful of Palestinian rights and Palestinian aspirations. So morally and ethically, the notion of one binational state makes the most sense. Practically, realistically, I gravitated, as did Hussein, to the idea of partition between two states. That has failed. And so part of the interrogation of the book is, why have we ended up in this dead end? What would guarantee failure is to continue on the same path that we've been on, because it has led to the failures that we've just, the horrors that we've lived over the last 2 years, or in particular Palestinians have lived. Palestinians basically were told, you can't resort to violence. Okay. You can't resort to boycotts. You can't resort to appeals to the United Nations to recognize your state. You can't resort to international accountability, whether it's the International Criminal Court, International Court of Justice. If you do any of those, you're going to be sanctioned. And that has been a clear message. You can't even resort to democratic elections in which maybe the Islamist party, Hamas, prevails, and then you have to form a government with them. All of those modes of activism, all of them, are illegitimate because, they were told, they are inconsistent with negotiations, the Oslo peace process, right? And so what are they left with? They're left with negotiations, which failed, and partly failed because Palestinians had no leverage. If I were President Trump, I'd say they have no cards. All of their cards have been taken away from them. So I don't know what tool they need to resort to, but they need to have some tools in order to balance this playing field, which is not just imbalanced because of the balance of power between Israelis and Palestinians, but because the third-party mediator, the most powerful nation on earth, has put its thumb on the scale of the most powerful party of the two, the Israelis. So the dilemma, if that's, or the impossible situation the Palestinians have been put in, they've been told they don't have any means of resisting and of trying to counter Israel. And then, of course, when they resort to violence, particularly violence against civilians, they are demonized by the U.S. and by others. But, you know, the question is, what other option are you giving them? And they need other options. They need other legitimate means of pursuing their objectives, or the most likely outcome is going to be they'll resort to violence again.
What about with the truly sea change in, I think, voter attitude toward Israel and Palestinians, as exemplified by the Mamdani 10 percentage point win in the mayoral race in New York? It's easy to imagine in 2026 the Democrats taking back the House, maybe taking back the Senate, maybe having a president win the election in 2028 who is far more critical of Israel. Can you see in the next year, two or three, the United States actually using its leverage, for example, halting, not just conditioning, but halting military aid to Israel until it's no longer the pariah that it is considered globally now?
That's a great question, a question that I ask myself all the time. As you know, my current profession is I teach at a university, and I see how young Americans whose formative experience of foreign policy is going to be Gaza, not just the horrors, the massacres that occurred in Gaza, the ethnic cleansing that occurred in Gaza, but the moral complicity of their government, more than moral complicity, the complicity of their government in allowing this to persist. And I think that's going to be an experience that's going to shape their view for many Americans for a long time. And so that gives me hope that a future generation of Americans is going to look at the Israeli-Palestinian conflict with a very different backdrop than preceding generations. And that's very important. Now, how soon does that translate into political power, into the perspective and the outlook of members of Congress and then of an administration? I don't know. You know, among the changes that we've witnessed over the last few years in attitudes towards Israel, it's not just towards Israel and Israel's policies. It's also a very important domestic component. You're seeing more and more politicians, senior politicians, including in your state of California, who are saying they would not take money from AIPAC, from the premier lobby or close support for Israel. I mean, I come from an era, an age, not that long ago, where they were sort of untouchable. Every politician wanted to get the endorsement.
Every president would go there.
Every president would go speak there, and it didn't matter. You had to. And now it may become a liability. At a minimum, people could take positions like Zoran Mamdani and not be penalized for it. He could say things and be elected despite that. But I think more and more politicians are recognizing that there's some issues. If they don't take a more progressive stance, they're going to be penalized. I don't want to sound breathless. This is all going to change. But these are indicators that on the Democratic side, the Republican side, attitudes are changing and the dam is broken. I just don't know, can they repair it and whatever right metaphor they will be. But it is something to take note of.
Our guest on Gaza Corner is Rob Malley, co-author with Hussein Agha of the new book, Tomorrow is Yesterday, Life, Death, and the Pursuit of Peace in Israel-Palestine.
Part of my answer to your question, and I don't want to sound overly cynical because I'm trying not to be, but things could happen that will make the Democrats, should they come back into power in 2028, temper whatever zeal they may feel today. For example, the war in Gaza could be more over than it is today, right? I mean, certainly the most murderous phase of the war will be, I assume, will be behind us. So that'll be one thing that they are not focused on. Secondly, you may have a slightly different Israeli government. It may still be Netanyahu, who knows, but it may not be Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, who are sort of the most extreme members of the government. And so you can imagine a future Democratic administration saying, that was then. That was that awful government. Remember that had Netanyahu, Ben-Gvir, and Smotrich. Remember what they did in Gaza. If we see that again, then we'll condition weapons. But now we have a government that is more, the one that we're more familiar with. It's not great, still doing settlement construction. We'll have to, you know, remonstrate and tell them not to do that. But hell, we prefer this government by far to the one that was there before. So we're not going to now condition, let alone withdraw aid to a government that is more, quote unquote, peace-oriented than its predecessor. So I don't know whether this strong feeling today that something has to change, does it survive those developments and for how long?
I said halt. You know, can you imagine halting military aid?
Yeah.
I didn't say condition because we already have kind of a law on the books that's never enforced. It's called the Leahy Law.
Exactly. Yeah.
The Leahy Law says if you're not abiding by human rights, you should not get arms. And that is absolutely not enforced. So I'm not confident that some law that puts in language about conditioning aid would actually be enforced. And your point about...
Let me say this about halting aid. So what I think is going to happen, and again, if you follow what some in the MAGA right are saying, and others are saying, I think what's going to happen, and I think if I were an Israeli leader, this is what I would do. I think they're going to wean themselves off of the $3.8 billion a year. They're negotiating, or they are about to negotiate, a new memorandum of understanding, because the 10-year understanding that was negotiated that you referred to under Obama is coming to term. And I've heard Netanyahu saying, again, in his place, I would do the same. We want to be in a position where we don't have to rely on American assistance anymore. We could pool our resources to do development. What we want is guaranteed access to American weapons if we buy them. And we're a wealthy economy. We have a large GDP, so we should be able to do that. And I think that's where we're headed. And I think both Democrats and Republicans and Israelis are going to try to find the glide path to that situation where Israel is no longer a recipient of military assistance. And again, from an Israeli perspective, I think that would be better for them. First of all, they wouldn't incur all this backlash in the US of people saying, how come we're giving a wealthy country so much money and yet they don't always listen to what we ask them to do? But second of all, whatever pressure the US could put on them would then be lessened. So I think that is the future towards which we're headed. And so for them to be in a position where they're more self-sufficient in terms of their own weaponry and therefore more self-sufficient in terms of their power, or independent in terms of their policy.
It's also important to point out, Rob, that Israel has a robust weapons industry. I think it's the fourth biggest exporter in the world.
Exporter. Absolutely. I mean, they're going to want to cooperate technologically with the US because of they develop Iron Dome or other means.
And you said before that you can envision, in the future that the Democrats would be more willing to, not put pressure on Israel if there's a change in government where the most extreme Jewish supremacists are not in power, Netanyahu, Smotrich, Ben-Gvir. But I think it's important to point out there truly is no opposition party in Israel that did not support the ongoing genocide. I say ongoing, it's less intense.
Other
It's
than the
less
Arab
intense.
parties, but absolutely right. The Arab parties, yes, but you're absolutely right. That's why, and one of the messages we try to convey in the book, this was not Netanyahu's war. He's a very convenient pinata where you could say, yeah, he's the reason why, and Smotrich and Ben-Gvir are the reason why. It's not the core of the problem, right? Even the settlement enterprise goes back decades, pre-Netanyahu, during Netanyahu, after Netanyahu. So this is not something, neither that nor the war that was waged in Gaza, are things that are unique to this government. Again, tomorrow's yesterday, that we have just not moved away from that mentality, frankly, on either side. And so something has to be done differently. And this notion, all we need to do is get rid of Netanyahu. All we need to do is exclude Hamas and we'll be back to business as usual. Well, the business as usual is what led us to the business that we've just witnessed. It's exactly one leading to the other.
And even if somehow this vague peace plan, which hasn't gotten to phase two yet, let's just say the bombs stop, the daily killings stop, because there really are daily killings despite the ceasefire. Upwards of 400 people killed, after October 10th. The question is, how will Gaza be rebuilt? And that's just unknowable. I think you've said that it would take up to the 22nd century for Gaza to be rebuilt, and that's if Israel doesn't destroy it again.
At the rate that Gaza has been tried to be rebuilt after the prior wars, yes, we would be well into the 22nd century before Gaza was rebuilt. Hussein and I wrote another piece after we published the book where we said, as a result of the Trump peace deal, whatever, Gazans have gone from pure hell to mere nightmare. So whatever happens, it's going to be practically unlivable for Gazans. Certainly, it's going to be a future of absolute control, security control by Israel. They're going to feel that it's fully justified after what happened.
And two Gazas.
And to God, I mean,
Fragmentation has been a constant policy.
again, this is why we keep saying nothing is new. Nothing is new. The fragmentation of Palestinians, that has been a goal of Israel from the inception. And look at how they're fragmented today. They're fragmented. Obviously, there's a diaspora, the refugees. They're those who are living in Jerusalem, have a different status. East Jerusalem, they're those Palestinian citizens of Israel, a different status. The West Bank is fragmented. I mean, you can't travel free from one area of the West Bank to the rest. There's checkpoints, there's settlements. So they're fragmented. Now, the West Bank has been divided from Gaza. Now, Gaza is divided at least in two. tell me how you're going to make a state out of those six or seven Palestines. It's virtually impossible. But yes, fragmenting, fractioning, dividing the Palestinians, that has been another feature of the way in which Palestinians have been dealt with since before 1948.
That is Rob Malley, the co-author with Hussein Agha of the new book Tomorrow is Yesterday, Life, Death, and the Pursuit of Peace in Israel-Palestine. It's been really, I think, important and illuminating having you on Gaza Corner. Thank you, Rob.
Or it's really been great for me. I've really enjoyed the conversation. I'm always happy to come back.